This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I am your host, Ari Barblat. Today, it is my hallowed honor and my humble blessing to be in dialogue with Robert Rosette. He is senior historian at the International Institute for Holocaust Research at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem. We will be discussing the book that he co-edited with Yael Nidam Orvieto, After So Much Pain and Anguish, First Letters After Liberation, published in Jerusalem by Yad Vashem Publications, 2016. Robert, I'm overwhelmed with gratitude to be with you today.
Well, I'm very happy to join you.
To begin, can you kindly tell us about yourself? Where did you grow up? What formative events in your life inspired the journey you would go on to become a historian of the Holocaust?
Well, I grew up in a small town called New Providence, New Jersey, which is about 18 miles west of New York City. And I grew up in a Jewish community that was Reform and conservative mostly. But I had a very strong Jewish identity always because my father and grandmother who were with me were Holocaust survivors. My mother was actually born in New Jersey, so she didn't have that part of her life. And I think that influenced me a great deal in terms of my Jewish identity, in terms of my interests. I suppose by the time I was near the end of high school, I was really asking myself, you know, why did the things that happened to my father and grandmother happen to them? And I was always very interested in history. I ended up going to Rutgers University, Rutgers College for my BA, and I majored in history. And I did a special project there about the Holocaust. I spent junior year abroad in Israel, fell in love with Israel, decided I wanted to come back, and decided I wanted to do graduate work about the history of the Holocaust, which is what I did. So I made Aliyah in 1978 and began an MA and PhD. I studied under Professor Yehuda Bauer and began by addressing, you know, why did these things happen to my family? But of course, it became much wider than that. And I became involved in many different aspects of Holocaust history as time went on. I joined Yad Vashem in 1981, and from 1993, for 25 years, I directed the libraries, but I always continued with research, and the other thing I always have been involved in is Holocaust education. So all of those together, I left the library in 2018 and became a senior historian in our research institute. And I'm also very involved in IHRA, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance. I'm part of Israel's delegation, and I just finished a year as the chairman of their academic working group. So that's what I do. I publish, I read, I write articles, I do a lot of lecturing. And I often say I'm a chief cook and bottle washer because any questions that come through often fall on my head. Try to answer them and see what we're supposed to say about a certain thing. What do we know? I don't do that alone. I have a lot of colleagues I work with to do that. But anyway, I've been at Yad Vashem since 1981.
What was your aim in putting this compilation together?
Well, I think there was a couple of different aims. There wasn't just one goal. First of all, to highlight the amazing things that are in our archives. We have over 200 million pages of archival documentation at Yad Vashem, and much of it is really amazing. And these letters that were written by survivors very near their liberation have a really special little piece of that history, because we've been discussing the importance of Holocaust testimony for decades now. But these letters are very much the first testimonies, not that anybody asked them anything. These are the things people wanted to write and tell people around them. And they're really the first unsolicited testimony people were giving. So on that level, it's important. The other thing is that we wanted people to understand the variety of experiences people had, because the Holocaust is obviously not one black and white event. There are many, many things that happen within it. And the survivors' letters reflect that very much. And I think the third thing is something that we've been doing for many years now, and that is that we understand when we teach about the Holocaust, we can't just teach about the major events or the big ideas. You have to go down to the resolution of people, and you have to talk about people. And so these letters were written by individuals, right, by people, and they reflect many things about what they had gone through and what they were thinking at liberation and immediately after. So that's a very important part of how we try to understand things. And it doesn't remain some sort of remote piece of history, but that we understand that this history, like all history, is about human beings and what human beings are going through.
How did you go about researching, editing, and compiling this volume?
Well, one of the good things about being at Yad Vashem is that we have a lot of help, because the letters in this volume were written in many languages. And Yael Didamor Vietro and I know a number of languages between us, but not all the languages that were necessary. And we used our colleagues in our archive and in the Research Institute, and even in our international school, we got help from people who helped find interesting letters and then helped us work with them when there were languages that we didn't read. I mean, neither Yael and I, for example, read Russian or Polish. We both read some of the Latin languages, and we'd read German and Hebrew, and Yael's Italian, so she reads that, and I know some Hungarian. But we needed help with some of the other languages. And so people within Yad Vashem were looking for letters. And then once they heard of the project, some people associated with Yad Vashem sent us letters that had not yet been put in our archives that were related to the project. And so that even happened during the course of the work.
Can you say more about how you located the various letters in this volume? Can you describe the research process that went into this?
Well, all of the material Yad Vashem that's been cataloged, and of course, not everything in Yad Vashem has been fully cataloged yet because there's so much material, but you can identify material by when it was written and who wrote it. And you can look for letters, for example, right? And then you can look for letters that were written during a certain period within our database. And that will help you to locate letters that were written by survivors. You can also use more specific terms, like names of some of the DP camps, to find letters that were written there. Again, harness all of the different research tools that are within the archives. And of course, that's also where we got a lot of help, because both Yael and I know how to research our archives, but we have people in the archives that are really professionals at that. And we could rely upon them to help find interesting letters for us.
Were there any letters you were personally moved by?
Yes, for sure. Because some of the letters are very heartbreaking for what they say. Some of the letters are moving because they have notes of optimism in them. Some of the letters are moving for the things that aren't in the letters, like the things we learned about the people later on, like when we learned about letters that were written and soon afterwards the writer had died, because they were so weak after liberation. So those were all very moving kinds of things that we found within the letters. If you want, sure. I can give you some examples.
Please, please.
Of some of that.
Please, yeah. I'd be very grateful if you could.
Yeah, one of the most, to me, the most moving letters was written by a woman named Adelheid Roet. And it was moving for a number of reasons. First of all, the letter was given to us by her brother Chaim Roet. And Chaim started the whole thing on Holocaust Remembrance Day that we call in Hebrew L'Kol Ish Yesh Shem, that everybody has a name. This was his idea, that we should read out names of victims of the Holocaust on Holocaust Remembrance Day. So I've known Chaim for a long time because of his work with us. And he brought us this letter that his sister had written towards the end of February 1945. She was still in Auschwitz. And she wrote the letter from there. And the fact that she was still in Auschwitz meant one of two things about her. Either she was a caregiver, or she was somebody in need of care who hadn't been evacuated with the large evacuations from Auschwitz that happened in January of 1945. In her case, she was somebody who was weak, who was in need of care. And she wrote a very, very, very beautiful and inspiring letter in which she talked about, well, actually, I'd like to read a little bit of it to you if
please,
I can.
Please.
Yeah. Okay. Let me see. I have it. It's a very short letter, and she writes the following. She says, "Dear beloved ones, after a hideous year at Birkenau concentration camp, Rosientje passed away in the hospital in Auschwitz, not having suffered. I was not present on 16 of March, 1945. Sunday, she became ill with diarrhea. She died on Thursday. Grandfather and Uncle Yes were gassed immediately upon arrival on February 10th, 1944, just like Aunt Reek on May 21st, 1943. October 15th was the last time I spoke to Aunt Clarita. Everything is okay. I stayed alive because of my willpower, God's help, and my unforgettable home, thinking of Friday nights and the high holidays, looking everywhere for father, mother, and the boys, looking for help to come home very soon, see you soon, as soon as possible." So her letter talks about what happened to her family members. She actually has a mistaken date about when her sister Rosienta died. It was in 1944, not 1945. We were able to find that from other information. And she talks about how much the hope of seeing everybody was keeping her alive, and her memories about her home, her very Jewish home. And the letter in itself is very optimistic, but she passed away the day after she wrote it. So to me, that's an amazingly moving letter to read, not just because of what it's saying, but because of what we were able to learn about it. And that's what Chaim told us when he submitted the letter. And then we also found other corroborating evidence, you know, historical evidence about what had happened to her and to the rest of the family.
What do the letters included here teach us about optimism and hope during the Holocaust?
Well, I think again, you read this letter by Edelheit, and she tells you what's sustaining her, her memories of home and the fond memories of her family and her own willpower to stay alive, of course. These were the things that helped sustain her. But I think that the optimism and hope more than anything else is the letters themselves in most cases. There are some letters that were written to various agencies where people were looking for people, and they're not as personal. But many of the letters are very personal. And again, the fact that people were reaching out after liberation to people they loved, to people who could help them, thinking about their future, thinking about how important it was to inform the people they loved about what had happened to them and their family members. This is all of the beginning of resilience. And so I think that this is a very important part in all of the letters just about that were published. Again, this idea that people were, there is hope in the act of writing the letters. And then within the letters themselves, again, they often express hope, as Edelheit did, that soon I will see you, soon I will be with you. Even if in her case, that's not what happened in the end.
What is known about the lives of the letter writers prior to the outbreak of World War II? Can you share anything that is known about their earlier lives?
Well, that's very much what we were trying to figure out with the letters. And again, the letters arrived at Yad Vashem in different ways. And sometimes the people submitting them told us a lot about the people who had written them and the letters themselves and the context. Sometimes the writer themselves did that, or the other people who submitted them, family members and others. But often the letters were shrouded in a lot of mystery. And it could take a lot of detective work to try to figure out who these people were and what their earlier lives were. We have a letter that was written by a woman named Sima Raisavi in Brno in the Czech Republic, which was at the time Czechoslovakia, where there's many things in that letter that aren't all that clear about what's happened. The first thing is, who is she? Because her name only appears as Sima, and we don't know her last name. But what we did figure out during the research about it was who she was. And that came in part because of the person who submitted the letter, who was a man named Ned Spindle, who was her brother. And that helped us figure out some of this. The other was that we were able to figure out through work with other resources, including pages of testimony that were given to Yad Vashem, that her name was Sima Raisovi. We figured out who her husband was that she mentioned in the letter, a man named Fritz. Okay, so once we knew who she was, we could go back to Ned Spindle's story, and we understood a lot about who Sima was before the war. Sima was the older sister of Ned and his brother. And when the Germans took over Czechoslovakia in spring of 1939, they dismembered Czechoslovakia and set up the protectorate in what today is the Czech Republic. Sima had a family gathering. She brought her two brothers together. She had a third brother who was no longer in the Czech Republic, and her parents, actually her mother, because her father was no longer alive. And she had a dinner with them, and she said to her two younger brothers, "You have to leave." This was before the war. She said, "You have to get out of here. The Germans are here." And she convinced them both to leave. And so the brothers managed to leave and to go to Poland. And Ned was a very gifted violinist. He was playing violin in the streets of Krakow. And he was approached by somebody who was associated with the British embassy in Warsaw, who offered him a scholarship to the London Academy of Music. And Ned said, "I'll go, but only if you take my brother as well." So Ned managed to go to England with his brother, and he survived in England. He was at the Academy of Music. And he submitted his violin to Yad Vashem because of the story of how it brought him from being a refugee in Poland to going to England. But in doing that, what he showed us was that Sima was what we call an Eshet Chayil in Hebrew, a righteous woman, because she took it upon herself to remain in Brno with her mother and not leave, while she urged her brothers to leave. So her urging rescued her brothers' lives, caused her to be deported to Auschwitz and then to be another labor camp where she lost her husband. And she writes such a moving letter about coming home to such an emptiness in Brno. So again, we learned that this woman was an amazing person, not just, you know, that she survived, not that just she survived Auschwitz in a labor camp, but that she was a person who was forward-thinking and self-sacrificing and willing to sacrifice herself in order to help her brothers.
Can you tell us about the letters composed by Jewish soldiers?
Well, we have a number of letters that were written by Jewish soldiers. And one of the most amazing ones was written by a young man from Milwaukee, a sergeant from Milwaukee. His name was Sammy Popish. And he writes about what happened when his unit liberated the Dachau camp. And the letter's amazing on different levels, I would say. One of the first things in the letter that is so amazing, he writes that, "Many times since I've come overseas while miserable in a wet foxhole or sweating out a Jerry artillery barrage or lying out in the rains pinned down by an enemy's small arms fire, I've asked myself, what is this all about? Why am I here? Why? After what I saw the past few days, it seems easy to answer those questions, which up to now seemed unanswerable. You see, 3 days ago, we freed a German concentration camp, the second largest in all of rotten Germany, at Dachau, just outside of Munich. So suddenly, this soldier who really wonders, what am I fighting for? Because I think American soldiers didn't understand that they were fighting to liberate Jews in the Holocaust. That's not what they were fighting for. They were fighting because they had to fight Nazi Germany. But, you know, war is horrible and they suffered a lot. And sometimes, you know, they weren't quite sure, why are we doing all of this? But then, as he said, it's a Jewish soldier who encounters survivors in Dachau, who weren't all Jews, by the way, but many of them were Jews. Now he knows why he's fighting. Now he understands what they've been fighting. And the letter goes on to explain some other really moving things, that when the Jewish prisoners in Dachau realized that he was Jewish and that he was an American non-com officer, a Jewish, they were amazed. How does this Jewish soldier come to liberate us? And then when they found out that he had been a chazan, a cantor in his synagogue in Milwaukee, they started asking him to sing pieces from the liturgy. And then they asked him to sing things in Yiddish, which he did. He knew Yiddish, again, as a first generation American in Milwaukee. And he entertained them, right? Singing to them. And he said that for the people in the camp, this was so important to see a Jewish soldier, to hear something about from their old lives of Jewish liturgy and the songs from synagogues and even some other Yiddish songs, that this was an amazing experience for them and for him. So you can just see the scene in your mind of these people crowding around him. And then they were asking him to leave, like he was a celebrity with an autograph, to write his name, to give his address so they could be in touch with him someday. Sammy Papish went on to become a very important architect in Minnesota. He changed his name to a less Jewish name because in those days, in the 50s in Minnesota, having too Jewish a name wasn't so helpful in academia. But he became a very well-known architect. And when this letter was sent to us, it was with some hesitation. And the reason was for the following. When the American troops entered Dachau, they killed many of the guards. And there was an investigation about what they had done and how many. And the official line was that they had killed something around 70 or 90 of them. But in some of the various places, it was said that they had killed 500. And Sammy writes in his letter, right after they entered, that they killed 350 people, which is probably the best source we have for what they did when they went in. And he explains why. Again, this is in retribution and anger and righteous anger that they were doing this. So it's a very important historical document as well for understanding how American troops felt when they encountered places like Dachau and the retribution that they took, which you can argue, you know, was right or wrong to do, but it was their righteous anger at what they were seeing and what they encountered and the horrible suffering they encountered, the bodies that were piled up in places like Dachau.
Can you tell us about the various displaced persons camps referred to in the letters collected in the volume?
Well, again, there's many displaced persons camps that are mentioned here. And there's been a lot of history books written about the DP camps. Most recently, Don Stone wrote about these. And so it's a known story. So what the letters tell us more is how Jews are feeling in those camps. And so that's really what I think we learned from the letters, as opposed to the camps. We know that so many exist. And again, there's a lot known about many of them. But I want to mention to you one of the letters that, again, is a fascinating letter, which also talks about how the person feels being in the displaced person camp. So I want to talk, there's a woman who wrote a letter, and again, a letter that took a great deal of detective work to try to figure out what it was all about. It was only signed Zahavit, and it was from Bergen-Belsen from the summer of 1945, when it was a displaced persons camp. And she wrote, the letter was submitted by somebody named Zvi Ringler. And all we knew was that Zahavit had written this letter in Bergen-Belsen to Zvi. And he was quite old when he gave it to us, into his 90s. He didn't remember much, but he did remember that they had studied together at the Hebrew High School in Munkacs. And so we tried to unravel the letter. And in unraveling the letter, we figured out who Zahavit was, because we have two things from that Jewish high school in Yad Vashem. We have a film clip showing people singing Hatikva in 1938, which is in our museum. And we have a photograph of some of the students with names on it. And one of the names on it is somebody named Golda Gluck. And Golda and Zahavit are similar names, right? Golda is gold, and Zahavit in Hebrew would also be gold. And so we were able to tie together that Zahavit could be Golda Gluck. Looking around in various databases about Golda Gluck, we found that she had been in Bergen-Belsen, that she was from Munkacs, that she had studied in the high school. And it was pretty clear that this is who we were talking about. And so once we could figure out who Zahavit Gluck was, or Golda, and then she later became Irene Smook, because she went to the United States and got married to a man named Smoak. We had her backstory and we had her story afterwards. So when she's in Bergen-Belsen in the summer of 1945, she's writing about a couple of different things. And one of them is the feeling she feels of still being in a camp, because they're not free yet. And they're not earning their own living, and they're given the food they're going to eat, and they're not free people yet. And how much she chafes at it, how much it angers her that this is still her situation. That's what she's writing to her friend Svi. And so we understand that being in a DP camp, especially one places where regular camps became DP camps, and in this case, the British took it over, it was not a great place to be in the beginning. We know from other letters and we know from all the research, as time went on, the whole DP camp situation changed. Jews were much freer. They can go in and out more. They engaged in all kinds of cultural activities. But in the very beginning, for many people like Zavit, it just felt like a continuation almost of everything else, other than that the British weren't cruel. I mean, they weren't always as kind as they could be, but they weren't cruel to them. They weren't Nazis or anything. So we see that. The other thing that she writes about in the letter is an upcoming Zionist Congress that would be held and was held then in Bergen-Belsen. And she writes about how Hitler would never have imagined such a thing, that here the Jews would be having a Zionist Congress after the war in Bergen-Belsen. So you talked about hope before. This is also a very hopeful thing that she's talking about here too. And so understand that from how she's feeling being in this camp, that she's chafing at the rules, but looking towards the future.
What new insights are presented in the letters here regarding Aliyah to Palestine during the Holocaust?
Well, again, there are studies that were made about Aliyah and people's desire to make Aliyah already at the time, because there was questionnaires given about where people wanted to go, and the overwhelming number of displaced persons wanted to go to Palestine, to mandatory Palestine, what would become Israel. That's not always what happened, because they were also reaching out to family members and trying to put lives back together and also trying to get out of their situation. So many of them gravitated to other places in the end. If they had family in the United States, it was able to bring them over later on to places like Canada. Some of them were sent to Sweden, where there was attempts very early to send especially younger women to Sweden to try to rehabilitate them. Some of them who were slightly older, perhaps, ended up in places like Paris. Others went home to the Netherlands. But the pull of Palestine was very strong on people at the time of coming to the land of Israel, and it was overwhelming. And we see it in the letters. There's an amazing set of letters that were written by the Brick family. And the Brick family was in Kovno, a Kaunas of today. And they were very important Zionists, the Bricks. Herschel Brick was the head of what was called the Palestine office in Kovno, which meant that he was dealing with issues of Aliyah before the war. And his wife, Luba, was a history teacher who had graduated university. And they had a young son named Aaron. And their story is that near the end of the Kovno ghetto, there was something called the Children's Action. And they managed to smuggle Aaron out and place him in hiding in the countryside. And then his mother, Luba, joined him and was hiding with him in the countryside. And Hirsch managed to hide within Kovno itself. And they all survived what was going on. They write amazing letters, though, after liberation. The very first letter is by Hirsch, who writes about how he's still waiting to get in touch with his son and his wife, who he hopes are still alive. And then in later letters, we see that he was in touch with them. And he talks about how many people they have lost. And he even writes at one point that even if he had enough energy to do it, the paper couldn't sustain all the ink he would need to write all the names of the people they've lost, which is heartbreaking as a letter. Then in another letter, the next letter where Luba is with him, she writes, and she talks about their ups and downs and the hiding and how hard it was. And she says her only hope is Eretz Yisrael for their young son. And Svi, who was an Aliyah activist, ended up going with them. They all went to Italy, and they were working in Italy, helping people travel illegally to Palestine, and then eventually it was their turn, and they made Aliyah soon after the Holocaust. Now, one of the most interesting things about this story is who the BRICS are. The BRICS came to Israel, and they Hebraized their name to Barak. And while Luba and their young son Aaron were hiding, Aaron often had a hard time. And the farmer that was the second person who hid them would often take him out to ride in the fields on the horse and take him swimming. And when he noticed how sad Luba was sometimes, he said to her, "Don't worry, one day your son Aaron is going to be a great man." So Aaron came to Israel with his family. He studied law. And he is Aaron Barak, who was the former head of our Supreme Court. So the man who hit him by the name of Maseritis was pretty right. Aaron Barak became a great man and was a great solace. So Aliyah was something that his parents wanted to do. And of course, they came to Israel and ultimately contributed a great deal to the state of Israel.
How were the letters collected here written? What times or time of day were they written? Were they composed by typewriter or by pen? Were they written in a hiding place or at a desk? Is anything known about the processes behind the composition of the letters?
Well, first let's start with the when. Okay. Because when we talk about liberation, most of us think, okay, May 8th or May 9th, if we're American or Soviet, Soviets have May 9th, Americans, Canadians have May 8th as the end of the war in Europe. Okay, that's liberation. But liberation was actually a rolling thing. And it starts in areas like the Crimea already in 1943. And it will reach places like Kovno in the summer of 1944 and the end of the summer of 1944. And some places like Theresienstadt will only be liberated on the last day of the war. So first of all, when they were being written, they're not. And then when we talk about first letters, we're talking about necessarily the absolute first letter, but the earliest letters being written. So some of our letters were written as late as 1946. And they were written in ink. They were typed, some of them. We have a number of them that were typed. We have some that were written in Hebrew, typed in English, Latin characters, because they didn't have Hebrew typewriters, but they're in Hebrew or in Yiddish in the same way. We have things that were written in ink. We have postcards. We have letters that were one or two pages or half a page long. We have letters that were 20 pages long. And it really depends who was writing them when. Obviously, some of them were set to write a 20-page letter. You're probably sitting at a desk and writing it or on a typewriter. Others were written in offices where people had gone to contact organizations, you know, little offices set up in DP camps or sometimes in towns where they were trying to contact Jewish organizations to help them go to America or to Israel or whatever they were trying to do. So in all formats, I mean, I don't really know what was written in the morning or what was written at night. That you can't really tell from the letters themselves mostly. But they would have been written in a variety of circumstances. And again, it depended also why they were being written. And somebody was writing to an organization, the aid organization generally had something more like a postcard that they were filling out or a form kind of thing where they were writing something on. Is somebody writing a letter, for example, we have a number of very long letters that were written by some Zionist activists from the Netherlands, who were part of an exchange group that was sent to Bergen-Belsen to be exchanged with Germans who were stuck in the land of Israel with the war, right? And actually, a number of those Jews were exchanged with Germans. The ones who wrote the letters we have were kept behind. But then they were writing to some of their family members who had managed to come to Palestine. And those family members already knew a lot about what was happening. And so those letters were often very detailed about people and events and things that happened after they left. And they were long. We have a number of them that are quite long. Also, I think one of the things you asked me about getting the letters, I forgot to mention. There were Zionist activists from Lithuania who came to Palestine. Just on the eve of 1940, they managed to arrive, and they were the Leshems, Yudit and Mordechai Leshem. And they were very, very active trying to help work with Zionists, sending food packages and things during the war. And then after the war, they were the address to which many of the Lithuanian Zionist survivors turned to. And that includes the Brick family, for example. They were writing to them, the Barak family, but a number of other letters we have. And the Leshems donated all of their letters to Yad Vashem that they received. So we have a number of letters that are written in Lithuania in the summer of 1944 to 1945, almost all of them relating things that happened, many of them because they really knew the Leshem family, and sometimes very intimate details about things. But in addition, all of them talking about wanting to come to the land of Israel and help, trying to get help to get certificates of Aliyah in order to come to the land of Israel.
How much is known about the later lives of the letter writers presented in this book after 1945?
It's very mixed about what we know about later lives. In some instances, we really couldn't figure out much. But sometimes we were able to figure out quite a bit because we were able to find testimonies by some of the people who wrote letters or testimonies of people who were with them. One of the most important places we were able to look for information about their war experiences and afterwards is something called the ITS, the International Tracing Service material, which is housed in Arlesen in Germany and which has been digitized. And we have it fully digitized at Yad Vashem, and today it's even online. And we were able to find things. And within that material, there are various kinds of things there. There's documents from the period, but there are also sometimes requests for compensation. And the compensation requests then often say a lot about who the people were, where they went. But even some of the earlier material, the cards that the DPs filled out, often ended with the destination that they left when they went to the camp. So you can then follow somebody and know that they took such and such a boat to New York or to Australia or to Canada. And then sometimes you could follow up with them. So in some cases, we really knew a great deal about what happened to people afterwards. One of the most interesting stories that we found out, again, what happened at the time and then after to some of the people was two letters written from Auschwitz by a woman named Jane Geismar. And Jane Geismar was in France. She was from the area of Alsace-Lorraine, and she was deported like many Jews more towards the interior of France with her daughters. And we didn't really understand much from the letters she wrote about what happened to her. But in trying to look online about her, we encountered a testimony by a woman named Francoise Azoulay. And Francoise Azoulay is Jane Geismar's daughter. And then we found out that Francoise Azoulay today lives in Israel, and her name is Dalia Azoulay. And she submitted a testimony to Yad Vashem. And in the testimony, we could get the whole story, including what happened afterwards, especially to her, about how the daughter, who is mentioned in these letters as a child, but without not by name, made Aliyah and ended up living in Ashkelon.
What were some of the most fulfilling and enriching aspects of your work as editor of this volume? What were the most difficult or frustrating aspects of the role of editor?
Well, again, I think the most enriching parts were fleshing out the backstories and then the after stories of the people, and also trying to understand what the letters were writing about. The detective work that goes into it is fascinating. It really takes you in while you're doing it. You become obsessed with trying to figure things out. And as I said, in our case, this was mostly what I was working on in the book. I was working on other aspects of it more, but the help I received from my colleagues at Yad Vashem, who helped me uncover all kinds of things. For example, the very first letter in the book is written by a woman named Nura. And one of my colleagues who's no Russian figured out, first of all, that Nura is a short name for Anya. And she began to figure out, unravel everything about who this person was, including finding a memoir written by somebody else that mentions the family story. So trying to figure all those things out and getting the backstory and understanding who the people were was a very, very enriching and fascinating experience. And so the other side is when you couldn't figure things out. And sometimes you really couldn't figure out a lot. There was very little to go on, and it was a little more frustrating. And I think that the other very enriching part of it was understanding that even within these letters that are replete with the horrors of the Holocaust, you could see the optimism of people, and you could see how they were resilient in writing them and some of the things they were saying, how hard it was for them to express things to people, how difficult it was for them to even to have to tell family members about what had happened to the rest of the family. But you can always, almost always see sparks of resilience within them. And I think that's very much the way we try to understand survivors. In the first years of the Holocaust, people spoke about survivor guilt and that all the survivors were scarred. And the true story is that some survivors were scarred very much, of course, and there is the issue of survivor guilt. But the amazing thing is how many survivors built new lives and became productive people and added to the countries in which they live. The survivors played such a central role in the first decades of Israel. And I think that that's something that we learn from looking at these letters, how this is beginning and where this is going to go. So that's a very important part of working with them.
What did you hope readers of this volume would get out of engagement with these letters?
Our hopes for the readers were a couple of different things. One, again, that they would understand that we're talking about people, individual people, and the varieties of experience and all the things I just spoke about resilience and hope within the terrible stories that they're relating, how hard it could be for them to tell what they had to tell, yet they still felt that they had to tell those things to people. And I think that's part of it. So it's understanding the complexity of being a person at liberation, why we call it the anguish of liberation, because liberation is confronting the loss and having to convey it. And so that's the anguish part. I think the other thing that we want, as I said, is understanding how documents can be used, because all of these letters can be used in many ways. They can be used in teaching. They can be used in commemoration. They can be used, in putting together podcasts like we're doing today, right? And to give them meaning, because when we only talk about commemorating the Holocaust as never forget, never again, if it doesn't have substance to it, it doesn't mean anything. And these are the kinds of things that give substance to those ideas. And I think they're very important for that. And we hope that readers will use them for that as well.
Are there common themes that manifest throughout the various letters across time and geography?
I don't know if there's one common theme that touches everything, but certainly, as I said, the horrors of the Holocaust come through in many, many of them. The things that people had to endure, the things they saw, what happened to their family members, they come through. And again, if you think that these were written, some of these things, while the Holocaust was still happening, and others, and immediate in its wake, these are very, very early testimonies, I said, about what happened. And so those early testimonies come through very strong about what people endured. When somebody is writing in the summer of 1945 about things that today we know so well, but they're talking about the way guards were treating people in Auschwitz, about the hard labor that they were enduring, about the hunger and the disease, those were new things coming out when these letters were being written. People did not know about them. And so I think that those are very common themes. And the other common themes we can talk about are the resilience and the reaching out, the hopes for the future that come through very strongly in so many of the letters. Not all of them, but in many of them.
Can you describe some of the emotions that are conveyed in the letters presented in the volume?
Yeah, there are, of course, many emotions that come through in the letters, obviously, because people have so many different experiences. Some of them, like some of the soldiers who were with the brigade, the Palestinian brigade, the Jewish soldiers who ended up in Poland and were working then to help get Jews out of Poland, have very mixed emotions about meeting survivors, right? It's hard for them to understand them, for example, in the very beginnings. And it's hard for them to hear their stories. And so we have things like that. Some of the survivors themselves convey really strong things in their letters. And Sima Reisevi, who was writing in Brno, writes the following And it's a little long, but it's worth reading the letter. She says, "My dearly beloved Ned, in the meantime, since I last wrote," because this was not her first letter, "I received your first two letters on 27 September, and as you know, my birthday is on 25 September. Your letters were the most wonderful gift. Thank you, for you have made me very happy. Nedenko, I too would give everything to be able to see you, only to feel you close, to feel your hands, without the need to talk, because everything I witnessed and endured during these last 4 years cannot be written, told, or written down. It's beyond human imagination. No one who has witnessed Auschwitz, the concentration camp, will be able to become human again in his lifetime, will never, never, ever be able to forget the horror. 5,000 people were burned daily, all mothers and children up to 12. Regardless of healthy or sick, everything was purely arbitrary. Those the SS found unpleasant were offhandedly sent to the gas. You'll not be able to imagine it, even though you know what life is all about, have experienced war, but this sadism was unknown to the world. I just want to give you a brief account, even though I will break down over it. I cannot tell it to anyone. Nedenko, I will only do it because I do not want to leave you in the dark. In March of 1942, Mom went with the transport to Theresienstadt. In April 1942, I went with Fritz. There we only stayed a short while with Mom. Mom went to Poland. Nedenko, we have no mother. She was gassed. The most wonderful and divine has been taken from us in such a bestial way. Then I went with Fritz, namely to Auschwitz. On arrival, we were separated, and Fritz, the man I loved endlessly, does not live anymore, gassed. And now the agony of Auschwitz began, where, as mentioned before, 5,000 were gassed every day. There were also work transports leaving for Germany. If one had exceptional luck, and when these dogs liked you a lot, they sent you to the side of the living, meaning to work. I was taken to the side of the living from Auschwitz, where they shaved our heads hairless, wooden clogs without socks, without linen, only with a prisoner's uniform, without handkerchief, with soap or towel, in short, naked as cattle we went. I was not even allowed to keep a small picture of Fritz, nothing. And that's how I came to Kurzbach, Germany. There, in the most severe cold and strongest frost, naked, we had to dig trenches. We received 150 grams of bread and soup, which was muddy water, per day. You can imagine this horrible, horribly hard labor. At noon, 15 minutes break. Aside from that, we were under SS guard from 7 in the morning to 5 in the afternoon. One was beaten, of course, and no, I don't want to tell you about that. In short, it was agonizing, and daily we were seeking explanations from the dear Lord. We were 2,000 women, and so many perished on a daily basis from hunger and pneumonia. I had pneumonia twice myself. Those who did not go to work were taken to the gas. Then when the Germans saw that the Russians were approaching, that everything was lost, the order was given that all of us that had survived were to be gassed. And the march from Kurzbach started to the death camp Grossrosen. And on the way, I could not and did not want to live anymore. I ran away. I wanted to be shot. 7 of us women ran. 5 were shot instantaneously, and 2, a colleague and I, remained alive. We both continued to live through the gruesome experiences until the liberation. Oddly enough, we survived. Totally exhausted, I weighed 32 or 34 kilos. I do not remember anymore. The Russians took us, our escape took us to the front line into their care. After many detours through Germany, Russia, Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, I arrived in Brno in May. The horror grabbed me, an utterly devastated city. I walked through the streets that were so clear, dear and precious to me, and cried my heart out. The parents dead, Max dead, my brothers somewhere in the globe, the friends dead, nothing remained, only the 2 small houses, Franciscans. So the emotion in this letter is amazing, about the suffering, about the loss, and then coming home and finding devastation at home as well. And again, that's why we call it the anguish of liberation. But it starts with her being happy that she's heard from her brother who's reached out to her. So you see the devastation, you see the pain, you see the anguish, you also see the hope. And again, her story is that eventually she made it to the United States and married somebody and had a new life. And I believe she was living in New Rochelle, New York, until she passed away. So again, the letters are very strong here. And if you can figure out what they're talking about and who they're about, that adds much more depth to them.
As we bring today's dialogue to a close, can you tell us about where your time and attention have gone since completing the book?
Well, one of the things we did after completing the English is we put out editions in Italian and in Hebrew. So some more of our attention went to putting out those editions, and actually we managed to correct a few minor mistakes from the English, and the Hebrew was the most improved of them all, because we discovered things by looking again at sometimes to make things a little more accurate. But most of my attention as a historian at Yad Vashem has been in lecturing a lot about Holocaust distortion these days. That's a subject I've written a number of articles about. And I just recently wrote an article about anti-Semitism in Hungary from the end of World War I and through today for a series Cambridge is putting out. So my attention goes to different historical aspects of my work. My real expertise is the Holocaust in Hungary. I do hope one day that we might get back to another letters project, because the letters are fascinating to work with. So maybe that will come along sometime. So thank you for interviewing me.
Thank you for the wisdom, erudition, and detail that you provided throughout the course of today's dialogue. I can hardly be more grateful for everything you taught us, and can hardly thank you enough for all the silent sacrifice involved in putting a volume like this together. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you.
As we end today's dialogue, I'm signing off as your host, Ari Barbalat, on the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. Today, I've been in dialogue with Robert Rosette. He is senior historian in the International Institute for Holocaust Research at Yad Vashem Holocaust Museum in Jerusalem. We've been discussing his newly co-edited book with Yael Nidam Orvieto, After So Much Pain and Anguish, First Letters After Liberation, published in Jerusalem by Yad Vashem Publications 2016.